Hello and welcome to Put On The Time, your go-to Newcastle United podcast brought to you by The Athletic. I'm Taylor Payne, and coming up on this week's show, I've gone to Yorkshire. I could do that.
Is that meant to be an impression of me?
I could do that easily.
Craig, crack on. You let me sit here and insult Chris and you do that. That sounds like fun. Love it. Saucer of milk for table four.
The Athletic.
Hello and welcome to Pod on the Tyne, your go-to Newcastle United podcast brought to you by The Athletic. Coming up on this week's show. Two more points well and truly down the drain. Tons up 100 days post-takeover. And Ellen Road awaits. Reinforcements on the way. Yes, hello, I'm Taylor Payne. This is Pod on the Tyne, and we're podding through the pain with Newcastle United correspondent Chris Woff and The Athletic's senior writer, Mr. George Culkin. How are we doing, chaps? George, how are you? You okay?
Yes, I'm okay. Getting there. Thank you, Taylor. How are you?
I'm not bad, mate. I'm not bad. Chris, how's tricks? Is everything okay?
Oh, absolutely tickety-boo, yeah, after the weekend. Yeah, absolutely.
Still hasn't seen Newcastle win a game this season, Chris.
I'm detecting like a hint of, well, no, it's not even a hint, is it? It's like a massive amount of like dread in everyone's voices today. We were saying this just before we came on air. Is there any chance we can talk about anything apart from football? So I've just, mastered a really nice recipe for roast, beef, ragu, with, short rib beef. Really nice. Yeah. Good. Gonna have that with some pasta.
What time do you want us around?
I don't want you around, Chris. Never.
Let's not pretend we're friends. Let's not pretend this is Morecambe and Wise and we all live together.
Yeah, me, George and Chris all sit in bed on a night.
Yeah, I just had a mince pie and I'm wondering when mince pies become sort of dangerous. A Christmassy mince pie.
Well, surely the internal workings of a mince pie, workings, that's not the right word. And surely the internalness of a mince pie is doused in alcohol. So that's not going off anytime soon, is it?
No, but the pastry.
The pastry, on the other hand, yeah.
If I disappear for a moment in the next 45 minutes or no, you'll know why that is.
Around about 40 minutes into this podcast, George is going to get screaming heartburn and have to leave. That's what that's going to be. Anyway, you dear listeners, you can subscribe to The Athletic now with a 33% discount at theathletic.com/NewcastlePod. You get full access to all our great writing and ad-free versions of The Athletic's podcast. So make your way to theathletic.com/NewcastlePod and sign up now for a third off a subscription. Right, chaps, unfortunately, we are going to have to talk football. And I want to know just how many times can a team somersault face first into the dirt at the finish line before you can start calling them a lost cause. Newcastle United's canny knack of imploding from a winning position is starting to look endemic. And before we do the post-mortem, let's hear from the manager.
Our performance up until our goal I thought was very good. And then I thought as soon as we scored, we went into a different way of playing. I thought our press dropped, but we became deeper on the pitch and we invited pressure. Not that I think Watford created too much from that pressure. I think most of their opportunities came from our individual mistakes. But still, I felt that we brought them into the game, and I think the goal sort of typified that, where we made a couple of errors, and at this level, that detail matters, and we've ultimately conceded and it's cost us the match. I look at some of the games we've drawn and you go back to even Norwich with 10 men, I felt we should have won. The game today, and I think the other games that we've ended up drawing, you think that we, at different moments, you know, looking for the second goal in games, we seem content with one, and that's never enough. And we need to keep our attacking intent all through the game. You know, maybe last 5 minutes, I understand it's slightly different, but yeah, so disappointing, lots to improve. We know it's damaging today because it was a great opportunity for us to beat a direct rival. And when you're 1-0 up with a couple of minutes to go, it's an even better opportunity. So we know that will damage our... We've damaged ourselves to a point. But you always have an opportunity at this moment in time. We're into the second half of the season now to bounce back from it. There was a lot to like about our performance up until we scored. I thought I was really pleased with a lot of what we saw. Without really creating an abundance of chance, I think we had moments. Obviously, Joe's hit the bar and he's had another really good chance. So we didn't really cut them open like I would have hoped to do. But as I say, the biggest area of development from today's game, I think, is once we'd scored.
There we go, Chris. What do we think of that? It's just not coming together quite yet, is it?
It's not. I thought it was interesting how after the game, because he sort of raised an issue which Steve Bruce had regularly talked about, mainly privately, but had spoken, so he'd hinted at it publicly. But basically how he said at 1-0, it's not the time to go into our shells, that's the time to go and make it 2-0. And then he talked about the player's mentality, maybe not thinking the same way. So he's basically getting across that the message that he is giving, that the way that he wants them to play, and you could see this on the touchline, he was trying to encourage the players forward, he was trying to tell them to push higher at the pitch, but instead, what there seems to be their default position when they're leading, and this is partly, he talked about that it's partly due to confidence, and I'm sure that it is, but also, the way that Newcastle try to protect that lead is just to basically sit deeper and deeper and deeper, stop passing the ball, just give it back to the opposition, essentially, which they're very good at doing, to be fair on them.
Yeah.
And then eventually, and they almost inevitably concede. And from the 49th minute onwards, basically the moment Alan Saint-Maximin scored onwards, Newcastle barely looked like creating a chance. That's how negative they became in that mindset. It was just interesting that Howe sort of referenced that. And he sounded a bit frustrated and perturbed at the players that basically say that saying, this isn't what I wanted, this is what they are doing. And Steve Bruce had been similar previously, so it seems to be that he was almost questioning the mindset of the players in that circumstance and what he feels they're conditioned to do.
George, Watford now join Norwich, Southampton and Man United on a list of opponents that have benefited from our profligacy. It's becoming a bit of a bad habit, this one, isn't it, throwing away leading positions?
Well, yeah, we're terrible in defence, and you know, sadly, that's not really been addressed yet. Kieran Trippier aside, and there was still that, you know, there's still that preponderance of giving the ball away, bad decision making in Newcastle's own half, and no, it just, I mean, incredibly disappointing. It was on Saturday, and you know, the position just gets worse and worse, except of course that, you know, they're still in this strange position where, you know, they're not adrift by, you know, they should be. But, you know, at some point they have to make a move, and it's not happening.
Chris, they're playing with such caution at the minute. You know, as soon as that goal goes in, like you say, we didn't threaten again after that. But I also feel, I haven't watched that 90 minutes, that it looks like they're playing with fear, and that is so dangerous for a team in our position.
But that's also entirely understandable, because they aren't winning it. They've won one game all season. They're not used to winning matches. And Howe also spoke after the game about how he's been involved with teams where somehow you're going through a winning room where you'll find a way to get over the line. But equally, there's the opposite. And when a team is struggling, You do question everything, and you could see that in the second half. Everything, I mean, I didn't think they were particularly quick at recycling the possession, to be fair, during the first half, and that was probably one of the criticisms you could have had against Cambridge as well. They weren't moving it around quickly enough. They weren't switching play quickly enough. But second half in particular, it was so ponderous, and also players did look like they were second guessing what they were going to do on each occasion. I mean, it's 23 points drop now when leading or drawn across 11 matches. 21 of those have been for winning positions, 16 at home. And under Eddie Howe, they've been leading against Brentford, leading against Norwich, leading against Liverpool, leading against Man United, leading against Watford, and leading against Burnley. And they've only won one of those games. So that has been the issue. And It's hard to know how Newcastle get beyond that. I mean, I asked how is this psychological, and he basically admitted that it was, and said that it's something that basically only wins itself will resolve, and that he hoped after they beat Burnley that that would sort of help resolve it, but it hasn't yet. And I mean, more than half the goals have conceded are in the final 20 minutes of games. I think it's 11 in the last 15 minutes. And they've only scored twice during that time all season, and that just shows that the longer the game goes on, the more Newcastle retreat and the more nervous they get. And until they can get beyond that, because they don't score enough either. I mean, they haven't even scored one goal a game. They're averaging less than that, and so, but they're in this position where they don't keep clean sheets either. So unless they score twice, the likelihood is they're not going to win, and that is just why they're in such a difficult position now.
Just on that point, I thought if we take this game in isolation, I thought this was the first time that the whole place felt really tense all the way through. I mean, I know that there have been games in which there's been tension, and obviously Brentford, which was end to end, and it's sort of, you know, lots of goals, who's going to win, blah, blah, blah. I felt to me, I was in the Leeds end, it felt to me that Watford was tense from the start, that the whole stadium was tense this time because the game was so important, and the team looked tense. And I mean, Chris uses that word ponderous. I thought they were ponderous in the first half, you know, which was probably their, you know, which was their better half. I just thought they looked so slow to move the ball forward, and it gave time for Watford to get back. And then Watford looked dangerous sort of on the break. I felt it was a tense occasion all the way through. And that, you know, anyway, that was just one of my observations.
Chris Allen, Sir Maximin, scored the goal, obviously, but he had a pretty average first half, and then came on and scored after half time and suddenly lifted the place. He's an absolute conundrum of a footballer, isn't he? I don't know what he does, what he is yet, what his approach is towards the game. It seems to be get the ball.
What was your tweet?
And try and run with it.
What was your tweet? What was your tweet?
He's like a man caught between two bus stops, and there's a bus on its way.
I love that.
That's what it is.
You also accuse him of fart-arsing around, and then he scored an absolutely wondrous goal about 2 minutes later, which I very much enjoy pointing out, except the laugh.
Absolutely.
I know what you're going to say. The laugh was on me because I think he had a poor game. I mean, I think he had a poor game, but at the same time, you cannot leave him out because he's the only player on the pitch that can do that for Newcastle. And it was a brilliant goal. It was an absolutely brilliant goal. But the amount of times he gave the ball away, you know, I thought, and he was a liability in other areas of the pitch. And it's, yeah, but nobody else can do that. So thank God he was there. But I enjoyed sort of gently mocking you, but I think probably you.
No, I appreciate mocking. I completely deserved it. It was good. But no, it was, the thing was, in that first half, he was so, so frustrating that he was getting the ball and instead of making the pass that would enhance the move or move the team up the pitch, he felt like it was his job to do that himself with the ball at his feet. So he would try and run past a couple of players. Even if he's not in the position to do it, there was a point where he gave the ball away inside his own half, and he was the only man back ahead of the defence, and it led to a counter-attack. Now, I like him doing it. I like it when he gets his shoulders down and he starts running at players. But he can't do it there. He can't do it inside our half when he's the last man before the defence. He has to start switching on a little bit, and he's got to be a little bit more intelligent with this, you know?
So I think that should take us on to Chris Wood. I mean, that thing, the point you make about those options was something that Alan Shearer pointed out on Match of the Day as well. You know, just the lack of options when Newcastle got on the ball. So, I mean, I know that Wood took a bit of criticism for his debut, but there was so much of that time he looked isolated. He wasn't getting the ball. What did you think of him, Chris? You were closer to the pitch than I was.
Yeah, I mean, it was that sort of game. Well, Alan Saint-Maximin is like the worst sort of winger for someone like Chris Wood in that sense, in terms of the way that he naturally wants to play, because you can see Wood is asking for the ball, and there was a little bit where he was asking for it down the line, and the ball just wasn't coming to him quickly enough. And I don't think that system really helped Chris Wood either. I think if it had been a 4-4-2 or a 4-4-1-1 with Saint-Maximin off him, and then actual wingers, that might have suited him a little bit more. And I was a little bit surprised that Howe stuck with the midfield three, because I thought they struggled against Cambridge last week playing that way. And I think they're going to struggle against teams who are going to let them have a bit of the ball, because there isn't enough creativity there. And for all of Joe Linton's work ethic and the amount of times he won the ball, he doesn't bring anything in a defensive sense either, which I still find incredible for someone that signed for £40 million for in an attacking way, but at least they're getting something out of him. But just that midfield didn't produce anything to help the front line. And then when you haven't got Sam Maximan crossing in, and I didn't think Trippier's delivery was as good as it can be. I don't think it was as effective as it could be. Wood was playing off scraps. I don't think he imposed himself enough onto the game. I don't think it was like he was really dominating when he did get it. I think it was only three aerial duels that he won, and he wasn't getting himself into the game enough. But equally, he didn't. It's not like that Newcastle were bombarding the box with really good crosses, and Chris Wood wasn't getting on the end of them. He didn't receive any of that service. The couple of rare occasions he got it, he had one where he was coming away from goal, and he managed to flick a header over the bar, but that was about it. So I did feel for him, but I mean, that's £25 million Newcastle have spent on a striker, essentially, to make an impact against Watford. It didn't happen then. He goes back to Leeds this weekend. They desperately need to get more out of him and find a way to extract more from him, because that's the reason why they paid £25 million for him, yeah, in the short term.
We have to also acknowledge he's only had a couple of training sessions with his new teammates by that point as well. It's asking a lot of him to suddenly fit into a team and particularly with the team, which I'm afraid it's sad to say is not a good team at the moment. It's difficult to expect him to perform miracles, because he's only ever going to be as good as the balls that come into him. And no, as Chris said, he just didn't get that.
It's interesting, Chris, you using that ponderous word earlier on, and George, you've used it as well. A lot of that, I think, comes from that midfield three, in that they're so slow to move the ball forward. I know John Joe Shelvey likes to play the ball forward and he likes to look for passes, but when the ball goes into that midfield, the entire pace of the attacks of the game just slows right down. And to me, Longstaff and Shelvey and Joe Linton, I know he's playing in a different role now, and he's kind of playing as like a spoiler breaking up play, but the three of them are too similar, and there's not enough dynamism in there. There's just nobody who is able to provide a spark, who might go past a couple of players and suddenly the pitch opens up in front of them. Shelvey's always looking for the ball to pass diagonal into the channels. Longstaff, I'm not sure what's going on with that kid. I don't know if his head's a bit all over the place. But he doesn't look anything like the player who was playing under Rafa Benitez. And Joe Linton's, bless him, just doing the best he can in the position that he's been asked to play. And occasionally breaking up play and taking the ball forward. But they're just lacking a player in there who can provide a little spark, who can do something different. And I think that's another area that really needs to be looked at. We must mention
I was just going to say on the midfield, it was a little bit puzzling that there was one point, and I think it was about 25 minutes ago, that Howe called Willock across from warming up to basically, he gestured as if to say, get your head in the game, and gave him some instructions and told him to go back and warm up again. And he tends to do that if he's going to bring someone on. And then Willock just didn't appear. And the midfield looked shattered at certain points, and we're certainly getting overrun late on. And yet Willock didn't come on, and I found that a little bit strange. I don't know what it was that made Howe change his decision. He seemed to have made the decision that Willock is going to be coming on here, and then obviously that didn't happen. And it was just a little bit puzzling. And just the way that the midfield was going, I think they could have done with it with a change coming in.
Absolutely. Also, it was nice to see Paul Dummett back in a Newcastle shirt, wasn't it, George?
Yeah, really good, really good. He is one of those players that gets better the longer he's out of the team. I mean, I don't mean that. In other words, you miss him when he's gone. He's always that 6-7 out of 10 every week, reliable. You know, it's one of the reasons Rafa Benitez referred to him as the most underrated player that he's worked with. And he came in and there was a sense of solidity there. You know, if Newcastle sign a left back this window, don't know if they will or not, but you know, perhaps then there's an opportunity for him to move inside. He does give that sort of versatility, but yeah, very good to have Paul back.
Nice to see him sliding, tackling wingers into the East Stand again. That's what we all want to see, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
I felt for Dummett at the end as well, actually, because for someone who hadn't played in such a long period of time, and I know the goal comes down his side, but Sam Maximan gives him no protection down that side to begin with, and he'd done very well to deal with that. And then late on, he looked physically shattered as well. It looked like, and understandably, he was struggling at that point, but I do think he gives more balance with Trippier being able to go forward down the right. So I think that him being back, and if they can keep him fit, he's also an option as a centre-back as well, if necessary. So I think that him being fit is a real positive.
Absolutely. And of course, agent Moussa Sissoko may have saved us from a defeat there as well with that absolutely awful miss when he was one-on-one with Dubravka after a misplaced pass, shall we call it, from Jamal Lascelles. And Sissoko picking up some boos as well, I noticed, during the game, Chris. It's one of them. We don't forget, do we?
No, he did. He was there. It was interesting before the game. Adam Leventhaler, who was obviously on last week, a Watford guy, we're chatting. A few of us chatting before the game, and I basically I just turned to him and I just said, has Sissoko scored for Watford yet? Because I just have a feeling he might score today. And he just turned around to me and he said, what do you think? he basically talked about him. He just gets the ball and tries to shoot from ridiculous distances. But I mean, because where you sit in the press box, you can see directly, and it was like almost my direct eye line seeing where Sissoko was. And even though he's showing goal, you could just see the way he was approaching it. He wasn't going to score, and he didn't look at any point confident in the way that he was hitting it.
I can't remember seeing a player look more uncomfortable trying to shoot in my entire time of watching Newcastle United than Moussa Sissoko. Even more so than Cheick Tiote. I always thought Cheick Tiote looked like he believed he was going to score, and Moussa Sissoko doesn't whatsoever. So yeah, anyway.
I'm just jealous of you that you could actually make out individual players. I was in level 7. I've not been up there for a long time. It's taken a week off my life.
You just got back home this morning, didn't you?
I know, it's taken a week. I mean, it's some view. It is some view up there. But I could not make out individual players. I didn't have, I was looking at vague positioning on the pitch to try and guess who they were. God almighty.
So did you do a week's worth of altitude training in the Himalayas just to get yourself ready for it?
Dear me, it was about 10 degrees colder up there than it was at ground level.
You do get a nice view of the Tynemouth coastline though, don't you?
Oh, gorgeous, yeah.
Right then, George and Chris have teamed up this week to mark 100 days since the takeover with a detailed assessment on progress on and off the pitch. So, how do we think the new regime are doing? George, at the minute, obviously because of the league position, everything like that, we've got a small number of fans grumbling. But as we discussed last week, there is plenty of room for optimism, especially in the long term, isn't there?
Yes, I think so. I mean, yes, there were boos at the end of the game on Saturday, which is, you know, probably for the first time that they were sort of that loud, albeit a minority. I think that was the occasion, and I think it was a response to the game as opposed to anything else. Funnily enough, I had a conversation with a friend who was collecting for the food bank outside beforehand, and he's a fan of many decades, older than me, and he said, you know what, I don't actually care what happens today. And I said, you have to care. He said, well, you know, I care, but I'm really not bothered. It's just, I feel so happy about the club and what's happened and, you know, and more importantly, where it's going. And I said this after the cup game that, you know, that in spite of that being a really disappointing and sort of dismal performance and result, that I could sort of see beyond that. And I do still have that. It's difficult to keep that every week when the team aren't winning. And, you know, I'd persuaded myself that that Newcastle would beat Watford and things like that. And I'm not usually optimistic, so it was disappointing. I mean, I think there are lots of things to unpack. The club is unrecognisable. You know, is in many ways it's absolutely unrecognisable. There is that sense going into games, as we wrote about in this piece. You still have to pinch yourself a little bit that everybody there is wanting the same thing. That it's a United Football Club. You know, there's no chance against the manager or the owner. It's war flags looks amazing. The stadium looks incredible without Sports Direct signs. And it is a football club again. And I think they've got a lot of things right off the, you know, off the pitch in terms of tone and messages and things like that. And just to give some sort of background, we spoke to people at the very, very top at the club. We spoke to people inside the dressing room. We also spoke to people who work for the club, and there is still this really positive feeling, and that, you know, that certainly in the Mike Ashley years, the feeling around the place was that nothing would ever change, that nothing would ever get better. Everybody now knows that it's going to get better, and it's just the bit that matters. It's not getting better at all. I mean, that's the kind of irony about it. You know, and so we'll maybe come on to talk about that. But the overall mood is very positive. The people at the top of the club are incredibly enthusiastic. They know they've made mistakes along the way. You know, We can talk about the manager search. There's a, you know, recognition that in terms of, you know, perhaps the big appointments that they could and should have gone quicker. You know, they're all very, very determined not to get relegated. I mean, I'm sort of, I keep, you know, the league table sort of says it's not a lost cause. You know, I just don't know. I don't know how to sort of gauge that anymore. But even if it costs a year in the championship, I know that's a big if because, you know, there are no guarantees. I still feel much more positive about the club's future than I did pre-takeover. And that mood is there. There's a mood of determination. One of the people we spoke to, I love this kind of phrase. It was, my God, we know that, you know, we were always told that Newcastle was a sleeping giant. It's a sleeping monster. Somebody, one of the other people said, our fans are fucking magnificent. I can't wait to deliver for them. There's all this sort of stuff. And it's really encouraging. It just, at some point, it has to be reflected on the pitch, doesn't it?
Yeah. Chris, and how are you feeling about the first 100 days of this new regime? It almost feels like these new owners are learning on the job as they go. Obviously, they haven't owned a football club before, but it's, you know, there is a lot of positivity, but it still does feel like they are learning week by week.
Yeah, it does. And it almost feels like they've got a sort of new car or a new sort of gadget, and they don't quite know how to yeah. kick it in the gear. Yeah, they know it's going to be great, and you feel, and everyone else does, but actually just trying to work out how to fit all the parts together. Actually,
We've not found the fog lamps yet, have we?
No, exactly. Yeah, it's just, at the minute it's a knackered old banger, which is heading for the scrap heap. But they need to try and get it. So in that sense, I do think I am still. If you'd have asked me when the takeover happened that we'd reach the 17th of January and there wouldn't yet be a director of football or CEO in place, I would have been surprised, and I would have been surprised as well that it took as long to dismiss Steve or move on Steve Bruce and then to bring in the manager subsequently afterwards. But it seems, or at least the noises are, that they've learned from those decisions and that what they're trying to put in place are for the long term. And as frustrating as it may be in the short term because of Newcastle's position, then they are looking at this as a long term project. It's not just to make it's not just for the here and now. It's to how can we put Newcastle on the best platform to move forward. And even if you look at the January transfer window, if in October the conversations that George and I were having with people very high up were that probably they'd maybe sign three or four players and not spend a heck of a lot of money. It looks like they're going to have to spend a lot more than they intended to begin with, and that's because the position has become worse. The situation has become worse on the pitch than I think that they even thought that was going to happen. So in that sense, it hasn't been the ideal start, but I do think that sort of enduring optimism and positivity for the future is something which is hard to quantify, but is very, very important. And I do still think that more changes will come, and that therefore that will be maintained going forward as well.
One of the big decisions, obviously, that the new owners had to make was replacing Steve Bruce, and Eddie Howe was the man tasked with that job. A question from Thomas O on the Real Time part of the Athletic app. He said, I'm all for Eddie Howe and giving him time. I also think that if we go down, he'll be a great manager to help us bounce back up. But the performance on Saturday, especially in the second half, just was not good enough. When can we start to judge the Howe regime for these results? George, what do we think?
Yeah, it's a great question from Thomas. Thank you very much for that and for listening. It's a tough one. I mean, I don't have a relationship with Eddie Howe, but I like the cut of his jib. Let me put it that way.
And
I've been very impressed with the way he's gone about his business. For this piece, we spoke to people who are in and around the training ground, how things have sharpened up. He's made an impact. Talking again to the people at the top of the club, they're really impressed with what he's done. He's thrown himself into this, you know, the hard work that he's doing. It's like all day, all night, all those kind of things. And I've been impressed with the way he speaks and talks and all that. And there's been really good feedback from players. So all of that stuff is encouraging. We talk in this piece about some of the little details on the training ground, so please check that out. But yeah, we have to, you know, and I'm supportive of him as well, and I want him to be a great success. We also, though, have to recognise at this point that there's been no bounce. You know, there was no bounce when Steve Bruce left. There was no bounce when Eddie Howe came in. And it's difficult on the pitch. I mean, the Man United game aside, perhaps, and definitely, you know, beating Burnley, that was obviously good. it's very difficult to sort of discern much difference. And certainly there isn't, you know, in terms of points, there isn't a difference. And the thing, I suppose, that concerns me, and I don't mean concern, and what I mean by this is that it concerns me about the sort of immediate future, is that, you know, the players who are being told to do stuff on the training ground at the moment, you know, that's fine. And yes, they're feeling the benefit. And yes, there's a, you know, yes, they take encouragement for that. At some point, though, they have to be able to look at what they're doing and feel that there's a point to it. And the only point at the end of that is results. So what I mean by that is, okay, you've left me out this week, but the team have won. So I can, so what do I have to do to get in the team? I have to fucking work my nuts off and I have to get back in there. And that's the only way that I can do that. Now, at the moment, if you're being left out and the team are losing or not winning, then it's very difficult for you to buy into that as a player. Same thing though for the players who are playing. Okay, you've asked me to play in that position. You've asked me to do this. You've asked me to do that. Well, we're still pretty shit. Now, obviously players have to take responsibility too. I'm not saying that, but a coach or a manager needs, you know, there has to be a buy-in. Okay, I see what you're doing because we're getting results, you know, and that isn't happening. And that is my concern. So when Thomas says, I think he'll be a great manager to help us bounce back up, theoretically, I don't have a problem with that concept, but it's a very, very long way from here to May, isn't it?
Absolutely.
You know, and from here to May and Newcastle not winning, it becomes, you know, teams that, last time Newcastle went down, it was with momentum because of Rafa being there and then Rafa staying. Will there be momentum? You know, if that was the case, I'm not so sure. So, you know, for his sake, he's got to start getting wins. It's easier said than done, but we're just not seeing, we're not seeing the merits of Eddie Howe on the pitch at all. And that is my worry.
Chris, some of the criticism that has been levelled at the owners, not necessarily particularly from fans, but from other people outside of the Newcastle United sphere, shall we call it, the evidence sort of suggesting that the owners are maybe too slow reacting in the fast moving world of football. What would you think about that?
I think that it's fair to have raised that point in terms of what happened when they first came in, and I mean they would argue back that they didn't expect the takeover to happen when it did, and if they'd taken over sort of 12, 18 months previously, they had a full plan in place and things probably would have happened a lot more quickly, or they would have had time at least to do that because they wouldn't be in a relegation battle. But the fact that Newcastle have been in such dire straits on the pitch has sort of raised the tension so much and made it more important to make decisions quickly. And obviously there was the situation with the head coach and then trying to bring in Unai Emery, and that didn't quite work out, and you could argue, well, Eddie Howe, they could have signed him up a month previously because he was out of work. But equally, they went through a detailed process to try and decide who they wanted at that stage. Now, the messages that George and I were getting coming back are that this idea that everything is going to be snared up with PIF, that there was maybe that issue sort of early on, but that those kinks are hopefully starting to be ironed out, that it is becoming a bit more streamlined, and that if and when a CEO and a director of football are in place, then hopefully that will only improve further. And I also think if you look at the Chris Wood situation, that was actually carried out very, very quickly. Newcastle was swift in terms of reacting to that. It was basically they were almost, they'd considered Chris Wood, but were almost forced into acting once they realised after the Cambridge game that they simply had to sign a centre-forward and they had to sign one now. And that's what they went and did the deal. And albeit, I saw some criticism over the weekend saying, yeah, but all they had to do was actually activate a release clause. That's not putting together a deal. But they still went and did the deal and they still brought him to the club. So hopefully in that sense, they are learning, but they are novices in many ways in this industry, and so it will take unfortunately take them time. And given that they haven't got that put that executive structure in place, they are sort of swimming against the tide in many ways.
Two players in by this time in January is pretty decent going. I mean, I know that we would like it to be more, and you know, possibly one of them should have been a centre half. But having said that, you know, that was my real concern. The kind of great phrase that somebody used with me was that the thing with PIF is that they don't just want to select people. They need to select the people who are doing the selecting. So I think when you look at the manager or look at the CEO, look at the director of football, that's part of what, you know, that's been part of that sort of thing. So it has been painstaking. My fear was that you cannot be like that when you get to January. You just can't. You've got to move quickly. So to get two players in, Kieran Trippier for a really good fee, really good player, kind of marquee signing in lots of ways, and then also Chris Wood at this point, that's allayed a lot of my, you know, a lot of my concerns. And again, yes, the people at the top of the club are sort of saying, this is getting better. We're understanding the way to work, you know, a way of working together. They also know the people at the club now better and they're comfortable with that. So that helps decisions to be taken more quickly.
Yeah, absolutely. And while we are on the subject of positives as well, the communication from these owners compared to what we've had to deal with in the past. I mean, the level of communication's been an unmitigated success, hasn't it, Chris? It's just it's like night and day now dealing with the club.
Yeah, I mean, we're still waiting for the follow-up to Lee Charney's programme notes, aren't we, from August 2019.
sarcastic bastard.
It's quite good for you, that, Chris.
It has been an unmitigated success. I mean, even just, it was such a simple thing, but just to put out a New Year's message to supporters. I mean, why was that a big thing? And yet it was a big thing to have a Christmas New Year's message. It was because of how starved that has been. And so hopefully that continues and there is that positivity with them. As I've said previously, I do think that words in that sense, it was an quote unquote easy win for them, and they have to continue doing it. And I all of the information, all the suggestions are that they are going to continue and try and be open with supporters and communicate with them going forward. But it's also a case of eventually words will not be enough. It is about actions, and they seem to be acting in the transfer market. And now it's about putting in place all of these things that they are saying they're going to do, and that George and I have mentioned in the piece, the refurbishment of the training ground, which is said to be coming this summer. Then in 3 to 4 years, a new training ground, in theory, all these sorts of changes. It's all easy to say these things. And what I'm pleased is that they're putting all about. I've seen a lot of people on social media going, oh, 3 or 4 years for a training ground, they just need to get it done. But it's actually, they want to have the right training ground. They want to have it in the right place.
It's got to be done properly.
Yeah. It's got to be done properly. And so the communication has been excellent so far.
Yeah, yeah. They've probably got to buy land. They've got to get planning permission. They've got to get the architects in. They've got to do all that properly. These things take a hell of a lot of time. I mean, the way it's been put to us is that, you know, it's the low hanging fruit is what they're doing at the minute. The point is they've taken over mid season. So, you know, they can't just go into the training ground and do the complete refurb of the current facilities now because the players are there. So they've done little bits and bobs when players have been away for games and stuff like that. And, you know, there's good ice baths now. We all remember those funny internet memes of Newcastle players training and wheelie bins. And they've got ice baths now. You know, they're good. The food's better. Things like that. You know, we've seen stuff at the stadium, like the windows being cleaned. Little sort of morale-boosting things that they can do. And, of course, one of the things
we've
written about,
as well.
Yeah, Alan from work is going to get his own...
Potentially.
Is going to get his own bar back again, which is really nice. No, it's not potentially. That's happening. That'll happen very soon.
Oh,
and,
good.
Yeah, that's going to happen very soon. And then they've started talking and acting on moving his statue back into stadium ground. Hopefully one day quite soon that'll be next to Bobby somewhere. There are complications because it's not on club land at the minute. I think it was funded by the Shepherd family. So, you know, there have to be discussions about what happens with that. But Nine Bar very soon. And then the statue, quote unquote, back where, you know, not back where it belongs, but where it belongs. And so those things are really important. The talking to former players, bringing them to games like Warren, our mate Warren, who came on the podcast, and just, you know, that stuff has been really good. And I go back to Takeover Night and Amanda Staveley looking down the barrel of a camera and talking directly to Newcastle supporters was so startling, you know, And They've kept that stuff going, and it's, you know, it's really, and they will keep it going. You know, I think once the transfer window's out of the way, they're going to redouble on communication and communicating with fans groups, and, you know, particularly the trust and things like that. And I think, you know, that's something to relish and look forward to as well.
I am looking forward to sending a text before the game saying, where are we meeting up for a pre-game pint? Let's all meet in the Allen from work. Yeah. Chris, is Peter Kenyon's another name that's been linked with a potential CEO or executive position with the club. What's the latest on all that?
Well, the sort of inquiries that we've made suggest that it's unlikely to be Peter Kenyon who is going to be CEO or whatever position Newcastle bring in, but they are making progress in that regard. It's been handled by third-party firms we've talked about before, both CEO and Director of Football. We think Director of Football will probably come first in the coming weeks, and then not shortly afterwards CEO. So hopefully those executive positions, you've got to remember the executive structure pre the takeover was Lee Charnley, and subsequently it is the board at the moment is Amanda Staveley, Jamie Rubin, and Yasser Romain, who's who's basically the chairman, but isn't there on a day-to-day basis. The club on a day-to-day basis is primarily being run by Amanda Staveley, and then so they need those people in position, but the hope is, or the suggestion is, that should be in the next few weeks.
And Georgia, any information about other parts of the club, the women's team, for example? There's been a bit of a statement of intent for that as well, hasn't there?
Yes, Amanda Staveley went to kind of visit the foundation and members of the women's team very recently. They're very, very excited about that. They're very excited about the impact they can have there. And, you know, I think they want to have a bit of an internal challenge. Which team might be the first to actually win something for Newcastle? That's not a bad little thing. And yeah, they have some really big and exciting things coming down the line with the women's team. So that's something that we want to follow up quite soon.
Right, we'll be back in just a second to talk about Leeds away coming up this Saturday. But you can stay bang up to date on the Premier League comings and goings with The Athletic's Transfer Daily. The Athletic Football Podcast brings listeners a 10-minute daily show of exclusive news and transfer updates throughout January from the very best newsroom in the business. It's exclusive to Apple Plus users, and you can sign up now for free with a 7-day trial. Subscribers to The Athletic will also be able to get access to the podcast via the app, and that's 33% off at theathletic.com/NewcastlePod. Right then, chaps, a big game, another big game. Every game seems like a big game at the minute, doesn't it? Leeds United, 3 o'clock on Saturday, the 22nd of January. We need a win, don't we, Chris? That's the top and bottom of it. We bloody just need a bloody win.
Yeah, well, just to piss on everyone's chips, though, I am actually going to the Elland Road, so that means Newcastle United will not win, if my recent record is anything to go by. So I apologise in advance to everyone for that.
I'm very, very happy.
I mean, I realise I say that as if anyone else who's been going to the games all season has got any much more of a winning record than I do, given they've only won one match. But yeah, it is. I thought that they had to win on Saturday, and I think Saturday was extremely damaging against Watford. And I do think if they don't win this Saturday, then I really don't see where they go from there, because Leeds won at the weekend and looked impressive in doing so. West Ham, they are almost pulling away from the drop, but the only team you can see at the minute getting dragged into the four at the bottom are Everton, and Everton are trying to make a change by bringing in a manager, and so it looks increasingly like it's going to be 3 from 4, just as it was in 2015-16. Newcastle have played all of the bottom five at home already and only beaten Burnley, so they don't have any of those games left to play. They go to Leeds, and they certainly can't lose on Saturday, but at some point they can't just keep going into games and drawing matches. They have to win enough games. Fulham did this last season where they just drew too many games. You have to at some point win, and I think because of the gap after Leeds, there's going to be like a 2.5 week gap. Psychologically, Newcastle need to take something into that rather than just transfers. I'm already hearing sort of from agents and the like that Watford, the draw was maybe a little bit damaging for players who might have been tempted to come to Newcastle. Basically said to them at the start of the window, look, come back to us in a few weeks and we'll see where you are position-wise. And if they'd lifted themselves out of the relegation zone, if they'd given themselves a bit of positive momentum at that stage, then that may have helped in the transfer market as well. So in that sense, I just think, every week we're saying it's absolutely massive, but I struggle to see, if they don't win this weekend, where those wins are going to come from to be able to survive.
Just following on from that, Chris, we had a question from Nath D as well, who said, are we any closer to bringing Diego Carlos in, and do you think we'll have anyone in before the Leeds game?
Well, inevitably, we're recording this podcast on a day when nothing has yet happened. We're 5 past 5.
So it's coming tomorrow.
Monday.
That's what you're saying,
Chris. Certainly, or it probably is going to come as soon as we stop recording this. But there is an increasing confidence. We've spoken to various different people. Increasing confidence that they can do a deal for Diego Carlos. The information that we were getting last night was that the next sort of 24 hours are going to be, the club hoped were going to be very busy for them in terms of negotiating potential deals. The two I think are in the pipeline. I don't know the identity of the second one. I don't even know the position of the second one necessarily. But Diego Carlos certainly is the primary target at the moment at Sevilla. I think he's going to cost a lot of money, but it looks like Newcastle are going to try and do that. It seems is keen to come because he's 28 and it seems like he's going to have a life changing contract presented to him at Newcastle, and he will be turning, he'll be leaving Sevilla, who are challenging for the Spanish title, and they are very reluctant to let him go. But I think Newcastle have just been so persistent and eventually it seems, hopefully they're going to, from their point of view, they're going to wear them down enough to be able to get Carlos in, and they're hopeful they can get him in before this weekend at Leeds, and they will finally have the centre back, which has been the primary target ever since Eddie Howe arrived as head coach, and they haven't been able to sign. Actually, they haven't signed a centre back since 2018. The last centre back I signed was Federico Fernandez on deadline day in 2018. Despite Steve Bruce spending almost his whole tenure trying to sign one, he was unable to do so. And so finally, the hope is they might be able to do that this week.
Can I just make a very quick point about the Botman situation as well? There has been this criticism of why were Newcastle kind of wasting their time of chasing a player who was never going to come during this window? And there is a feeling at the top of the club that certainly wasn't the case, that the player was actually very, very keen to come, and that the sort of early negotiations, you know, with the club was that they were receptive to it too. But in actual fact, it was Lille's position that changed, and that their position in the league meant that they were no longer receptive to letting him go. And so Newcastle have had to move on. So, and that is one of the problems with this month. You can do your homework as much as you want. You think you can get good feedback from both players and clubs. And then as days go on, situations change. Another thing that they've had to contend with, I'm told, they've gone to clubs in this country, and those clubs, certainly at the moment, are reluctant to lose players because of COVID, and suddenly, you know, being without players for COVID. So they, you know, so that is something else. It's been a tough thing, but I just wanted to make that point about Botman, because that was sort of how I looked at it as well. Why, you know, why are they spending all this time going after him? Well, that was the reason.
So at the moment, no Botman, but Chris, what about Robin?
Lock it up good and tight, guard. The Joker's on the loose again.
Come on now.
I am. We're going my there. Resignation we're going this podcast there again. Is now in my email inbox. I'm going to send this. There again.
Every week. He's doing the same joke every week.
Chris, come on. Imagine my delight when I saw this week that there was a claim that Newcastle had agreed terms with German left-back Robin Gosens. Come on then, Chris, you're the boy wonder. You tell us what the latest is with this. There has been some cold water poured on this, but what's happening with Robin Gosens?
Well, he is a name who's been mentioned, but, I mean, A, he's injured. B, he's a wing-back in Newcastle, and it's not a priority position for Newcastle, so I'm not completely ruling this one out, is it? But it's not a priority position right at this moment in time. I don't think it is one of those deals that is necessarily closed, although that is not the information that we're getting. James Horncastle, our Italian football writer, has also checked it out at his end, and he's getting the same sort of information back. And so I don't think that one is an imminent sort of signing. So please, please, please stop making that joke.
That's a shame, isn't it? That's such a shame, Chris. I mean, can you imagine? Could almost feel the dread coming through the internet connection as I'm saying that.
You're the joker, Taylor. Christ.
George.
What?
Obviously, Rafa Benitez left his position at Everton Football Club this week. We would imagine now, after all the chat in the last few months, that this might have a knock-on effect to the potential of Sean Longstaff leaving and joining him at Everton. Is that what we think is going to be the case now?
Yes, I mean, I would certainly have thought so. I mean, on Longstaff, I mean, I think there's, you know, dilemma there about whether to stay and fight for his place. I think that's what he would be minded to do because Newcastle's his team, and you know, the club have talked about contracts, but once January's out of the way, I mean, I can't imagine that Everton will be a realistic prospect now that Rafa's gone. I spoke to Rafa this morning, by the way, and obviously very disappointing. It sounds, you know, it sounds like Everton's been every bit as dysfunctional as Newcastle was under Mike Ashley. And of course, he asked about Newcastle because he always does when we chat. But yeah, a tough gig for Rafa there. I think, you know, one thing you can say about him is he never gives himself an easy life. And you know, all the people who said at the time that that was not a not a good decision on either side. I think it's difficult to argue. It's difficult to argue against that now.
It was a tricky one, that one for him, wasn't it? I always felt like it was a no-win situation for him at Everton because he was always just going to be Rafa Benitez, the former Liverpool manager. And it was so tough for him to go into that job and try and turn it around. And Everton as well, like you say, they've thrown good money after bad money for years and years now trying to sort that squad out, and they still haven't managed to find the correct ingredients. Yes, that'll do for all of that. We still are without a new centre-half, and we're hoping that won't be the case soon, according to Chris. And that is indeed the real quiz. However, just before we finish, John C. has asked, do Newcastle believe they can transform their season with predominantly defensive signings, as has been briefed? Given that we need wins, I'm surprised strengthening the attack seems to be such a low priority. Seem to be plenty of attacking options available in the loan markets. Chris, this is an interesting one, isn't it? Obviously, Chris Woods came in, and you would hope that he would be able to hit the ground running and get a few goals, but getting the ball to him seems to be an issue as well.
Yeah, I mean, Newcastle are prioritising at this very moment in time to bring in centre-backs, because that has been the key for a long period of time. And if Newcastle keep conceding goals, they're going to be relegated. If they keep conceding more than one goal a game, they will go down, because partly because of what John said, because they don't score enough, but also teams who don't keep clean sheets don't stay in the Premier League. So they have issue. The issue is that the problem is they have issues all over the pitch. And Eddie Howe himself even said, look, we're open to potentially signing players for any position. And he's quite clear about that. And I do think if an appropriate goalkeeper came up and Newcastle could do the deal, they would consider doing that. So they do want an attacking midfielder as well. They do potentially want another forward before the end of the window. In terms of when John mentions the loan market is one that Newcastle have identified, but that they realise is really going to spring into life in the last week of the window. Clubs will try and, particularly players that they're looking to offload, they will try and offload them permanently to begin with, or for a higher loan fee, or with a higher percentage of their wages to begin with. Also, as George mentioned earlier in the podcast, COVID is proving to be an issue for clubs who don't want to let players go too early while they're having COVID outbreaks. Newcastle are the same. Elliot Anderson has, as I wrote last week, has a deal agreed to go to Luton Town, but Newcastle haven't let him go yet because they haven't got enough players fit at the moment or available because of COVID. So that is delaying that as well. But offensive signings they do also want as well. Todd Cantwell of Norwich City is someone who they like, and it's sort of a creative midfielder. He's one of the many names who's been mentioned. And so I do think that in an ideal world, they will bring players in before the end of the month. The issue that they also have is that they already have now 27 senior players in their squad, haven't signed two more. You can only register 25 by the end of the month, so they need to move players on to sign some, or they're going to have to leave them out of their squad, and that's going to be expensive as well. So it's a very complicated window, and Newcastle are trying to do a lot of business in a window that is not advisable to do a lot of business in, as Amanda Staveley herself referenced in an interview in November. So yes, John, ideally they will make offensive signings, but also they just have to strengthen so many areas of the team that it's basically plugging gaps where they can.
Right then, just enough time to round up a couple of things and let you know what's going on in the next few weeks. No games to preview in the next two shows, but we do have some fun stuff lined up and in the pipeline. Can't say any more at this exact moment, so let's not make a song and chicken dance of it. Here's something we can say, though. We've had a couple of questions from the real-time feed this week, but we will go full mailbag next week. And we're all looking forward to that. So get your requests, queries, comments, complaints, and general wonderingments to us. And keep an eye out for a post in the real-time section, and maybe a tweet as well on the old Twitter. Thanks very much, George and Chris, for your time. I know you two chaps are very, very busy at the moment, so thanks for coming on and talking to us. I hope you're all well, and we shall speak to you all very soon. That's it for today. We're going to be back next week. From everybody at Pod on the Tyne, a hearty cheerio.
The Athletic.